For over 6 years, Hank Thorpe hosted All of the Above Radio, the most intelligent, honest, and eclectic combo of music and talk that you never heard. But the more things change, the more things stay the same. Hank is back with a new version of the old scene. No more music, no more time constraints, but he still has great stories, great interviews, and more passion than a novel with Fabio on the cover. Once upon a time, Hank Thorpe was your bastion of good music, good talk, and full escapism. Now, Hank is your bastion for punchlines, passion, and perspective. Hank Thorpe, your former, present, and future favorite podcast host, presents all new, all different, but still, All of the Above.
This one is years and years and years in the making, and I'm so glad we finally got this ball rolling. Welcome to All New, All Different, All of the Above. New version of the old scene. My name is Hank. Hey, how you doing? I know it's been a few months for me to give you content. I'm fully aware of this. Life just keeps on happening, ladies and gentlemen. It does not stop happening. It just keeps happening. And as much as you try to press pause, as much as you try to carve out some time for yourself, as many ideas as you have to multitask that time for yourself, still hard. It's funny, the older I get, the more I realize just how important sleep is. You gotta kind of run the hierarchy in your head of get good sleep or... don't get sleep, get everything done, or get enough sleep so that just the essentials get done. It's tough. So I haven't talked to you since, I want to say, it was early May. A fantastic episode, by the way. If you haven't heard it yet, please do go check it out. And anybody that's new to the show, I say hello. My name is Hank. Hey, how you doing? Once upon a time, I did a show called All of the Above Radio. You can find it, actually, if you scroll down, if you're on Spotify or if you're on Apple Music, wherever you are, you scroll down a little bit and you go listen to digging into the archives, I think is what I called it. I went and gave you two different best of All of the Above Radio shows, where it was my old freeform show of music and then random topics that were on my mind. These days, it's all new, all different, all of the above. For those of you who are familiar with the show, please just stick with me. You can scoff at everybody who's brand new and be like, where you been? But the newest version of the show is just me talking to you, and sometimes I get to talk to somebody. I get to have an interview, and I love doing them. And I gotta tell you, people that are passionate about what they do or who they are or how they feel, it's real easy. You just ask them a question, sit back, and watch them go. It's a lot of fun. And I say that this episode is years and years and years in the making is because I've known this guy for a very long time. I've known the job he held for a very long time. And I've wanted him to be a part of this show for a very, very long time. And it was a chance meeting back in New Jersey in May that started the ball rolling. Actually, it was a chance meeting from he and somebody else about 3 to 4 weeks before that really started this. I got a text one day from a buddy I graduated high school with and said, hey, this dude says hello. He says he wants to be on your show. I looked at my phone. I said, I didn't know I was still that high in demand, but okay, happy to help. And then when my wife and I were back in New Jersey, a couple nights before I was in a wedding, I met up with this guy, along with a couple other folks. And we're chatting, and we had a bunch of awesome conversations. So many stories about work and not work. All of it amazing. We're getting there. More on that in just a little bit. I'm going to sit back. I'm going to listen along with you because I can't get enough of this interview that I just heard. I'll talk to you on the other side just as soon as I give you this little bit of knowledge. Two little bits of knowledge, actually. I can look back on my life and know that one thing has been consistent since roughly 1987 or 8. I have been a devoted, devout, ever-loving New York Football Giants fan. If you want to ask me, if you want to ask me where my allegiances lie to really anything, my close family, my close friends, and New York Giants football. Those are from like the length of my life. Now, of course, I am an adult and I've grown a lot. I am now married. I have a lot more going on in my life, but the New York Giants have always been there. Good, bad, middle of the pack. They have always been there for me. Ever since childhood, I have loved pro wrestling, I've loved baseball, I've loved hockey, I've loved baseball cards, I've loved playing tennis, I've loved playing racquetball, I have enjoyed indoor rock climbing, I've dated, I've had friends, I've lost a parent, I've lost a grandparent. I have seen so much in my life, and since I was young, one of the consistents that has never gone away is New York Giants football. And I will tell you, the conversation you're about to hear, maybe, just maybe, you're not a New York Giants fan. I forgive you. But you listen to the stories, because the interview you're about to hear is something that kind of plays out like it could be an amazing podcast, or it could be a confidential style book like an Anthony Bourdain would have written. I'm not just hyping this up because I just got done with the interview at time of recording, but it's because it's that good. And the other thing I wanted to let loose with real quick. I have a bit of a problem. And no, it's not the love of the New York Football Giants. Anybody with that opinion, I repeat, I forgive you. I have a problem every so often that I want to chime in conversationally so that either A, I sound like I am, or I give you the impression I'm listening, or I give you the impression that I'm not stupid. And there's actually one moment in this conversation where I didn't blockade the conversation, but it could have frozen. It could have frozen. Not in a bad way, but in a way of, Hank, that was not important information. Why are you talking right now? And I understand. I'm super critical of myself, so that you guys don't have to be. But at the same time, I'm telling you, my love of New York Giants football runs through this conversation, And the once or twice I accidentally step on my interview because I'm trying to sound smart, that's going to happen too. Sit back. Relax. Don't be too relaxed if you're driving. And enjoy. I'll talk to you on the other side. I want you guys to buckle up. This is going to be very entertaining and super duper informational. I am now talking with Mr. Matt Shauger, a former member of the New York Giants scout team. And I know I butcher your title every time I talk about you. So this is where you give us your exact title and then what you did as you were working for the New York Giants.
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of stuff. So essentially, I was a pro scout. You know, we'll just keep it like that because, you know, that makes it that much simpler. But, you know, it's funny when you hear about scouts in sports and the first question you get as a scout is people say, oh, what college? You know, what colleges did you go to? And the answer is I didn't go to any.
Okay.
So the way scouting works, especially in the NFL, is you essentially have kind of two pathways. You've got your what they would call amateur scouting in baseball, which is college pathway. In football, it's college scouting. And the other avenue is obviously professional scouting, which is pro scouting, where you're looking at teams, you're looking at, you know, the way my job would work in a nutshell is during the season, everything's broken into different situations. So during the season, you would have preparation for the upcoming opponent. So mm-hmm. you're looking, you know, essentially at the club that you're going to go play against, you know, usually a week or two ahead of the coaching staff. And then doing everything in your power to kind of help them prepare for the game. So it's breakdown of, you know, now there's a lot of statistical components. Analytics is the fun word everybody likes to throw around. There's a lot of that in there. There's evaluation, scouting evaluations of every player on the team. You know, now the way it's done, you know, you're going to fuse data and video into your presentation.
Yeah.
So everything in football is situational, right? So you're trying to do your best to prepare the coaching staff. In the NFL, the difference between the NFL and college is obviously it's a matchup league. So having evaluations on every player and knowing one-on-one matchups, how you can take advantage of situations, that's all in there. So you're preparing the coaches. To a lesser extent, you're going to prepare the players because all that information is going to eventually get to the players.
Mm-hmm.
And then as your week goes on, you're doing that in addition to how do you constantly upgrade your roster. So you're looking for guys that are going to hit the waiver wire. You're looking at players that you could acquire via a trade. You know, you always want to be cognizant of evaluating your own roster and how can you, you know, figure out who's the last guy on your team and how can you upgrade that position. You're constantly thinking about that. And that's throughout the year, honestly, but, you know, in season in particular. And then as the season winds down, you start to get into free agency and, you know, eventually the draft and so on and so forth. And then by, you know, the middle of June, things wind down and training camp rolls around and it's 0-60 and you're back up and running.
So now, first and foremost, the job that you just described, whether it was the week prep or free agency or the draft, were you responsible at any given point for all of those?
For so the draft is handled by the college department. The only thing I did in terms of the draft stuff was I would kind of work the trade line on draft day.
Sure.
So, you know, typically you have about three or four people and then you'll have, you know, some senior guys, assistant GM. Typically you want to free up the head coach and the GM, unless they need to get in on a high level conversation, but you know, you got to work the trade line.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of that stuff, when you do the big trades, that gets worked out, you know, a day or two or a week before, you know, the the event, but you get into the third round of the draft and phones are ringing and you're evaluating trade proposals and you're bringing them to the GM and okay, yeah, let's run with that. And you know, there's 5 minutes on the clock and you gotta get the league office on the phone and execute the trade and the paperwork's gotta go in. So in terms of the draft, that was really my big contribution was, I'd sit in on all the draft meetings and, worth the trades. Occasionally they'd ask you to look at a player or two before the draft, go to pro days, that kind of thing. But I largely was uninvolved with the draft other than, in those areas.
So even though you were not directly involved in the draft, you were... The old adage goes that the NFL is a 365 days a year job, or that the season...
There's no question about it.
Okay, so the season truly never ends.
Truly never ends, and you got to remember, when it's draft time, it's also free agency time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, in the NFL, there's two different years, right? There's the year that everybody in the world goes off of, which is the calendar year, and then there's the NFL league year, which is totally different than what we're all accustomed to. The NFL league year starts typically the first day of free agency.
Which is what, right around March 15th or so?
Yeah, exactly. It's usually the middle of March. So that's when the new league year kicks in, and that's where all the contracts change. That's when people officially become unrestricted free agents. That whole thing. So, as a pro guy, your focus is on free agency. And then, the start of free agency is when you sign those big money contracts. But there's different waves that go into free agency. There's that first wave where the big money goes. The second wave is when you get the more reasonable contracts. And then that third wave will continue, all the way up into June, really. And, typically it winds down around draft time, but then you'll get some bargains right after the draft. So you're constantly working on that stuff, in addition to the draft meetings and school visits and all that kind of stuff that's going on.
So what we have not covered yet is the years in which you worked for the New York Giants. Can you please?
Yeah, so I started out, funny enough, in London, England.
Okay.
And you're probably like, what are you doing over in London? So I graduated from college, and I thought I was either going to go into hockey operations, funny enough, or I was going to go to law school.
Okay.
I was working in the pharmaceutical industry at the time, working full-time doing that, going to school full-time, and then right around graduation, those were kind of my two plans. And got a call out of the blue from the head of the program, and they said, hey, there's an opportunity with the NFL. Are you interested? Yeah, am I interested? Yeah. Tell me where to go.
What was your major, by the way?
My major was business administration and sport management.
Okay.
So, from there, I went to Seton Hall. So I went to basketball school, so obviously I didn't play football in college, and but to have the opportunity to go to work for the NFL,
mm-hmm.
you grab it right away. So I said, all right, what do I need to do? Where do I need to go? Who do I need to talk to? Essentially what it turned into was a 6-week visit to Tampa, Florida in the middle of February. And back then there was a thing called the NFL Europe League.
Yes,
everyone probably remembers. Mm-hmm. So I got down to Tampa, was excited. I said, all right, there's six teams. Which team do you want me to go work for? They all kind of looked at me and they said, oh, you're with the international guys. I said, the what? They said, the international guys. Now I'm thinking, all right, so I figured, it's like an operations kind of thing. Or, what do you mean international? Like the people that set up the travel, that go, no, we need the international players. That's where I was.
What?
Me being a naive American, I'm like, what are you talking about? So, as it turned out, by league rule, you had to have, I want to say it was between 8 and 10 international players on the roster for each club.
The CFL
does. When I say international, Canada doesn't count. Non-North American. So the priority markets back then were Canada, or were Mexico, Europe, and Japan. Japan, okay. They'd been playing football for about 100 years by that point. It was they had started playing prior to World War II. Obviously, after the war, it got really big, you know, with all the service members over there. It's a really developed game over there. It's owned by corporations. I mean, I got to talk about football in Japan for hours. It's awesome. But so those were the markets. And each team had to have one starter on each side of the ball that was a non-North American player. So, you know, all these guys were down there. It was my first exposure to that. And had a great, great time. Worked with those guys throughout camp. And that led to a full-time job. They said, hey, we really could use your help over in Europe. We got 100 things we got to do. We got to try to find players. We got to grow the game. We got to introduce flag football. We got to try to do market outreach. We got to, you name it. I mean, it was 1,000 things. So, packed up, this is summer of 2003. Moved to London. I'd never been to London in my life.
Wow.
I'd been to Ireland once.
Okay.
But I'd never been to London, and moved into a flat and hit the ground running. And I was there for 2 years. I loved it. It was a great experience. Traveled all around. You probably saw this stuff recently with, you know, all these Americans that are getting snatched up by the, I don't even know they're not called the KGB anymore, but whatever that service is, you know, where they're just basically taking Americans hostage and then trying to barter for thugs that we have in prison over here.
Sure.
I'm sure you follow that. That's a real thing. I mean, that happened. I was over in Moscow covering a football tournament for 10 days and had the KGB follow me.
Whoa.
And introduced themselves. They were really, you know, thankfully I wasn't part of that story because this was, you know, a few years after Putin had just taken office. But yeah, I mean, that's a real thing. And but, you know, for the most part, my experiences over there were great. I loved it. It was hard to leave. I had an opportunity to go to the Giants in 2005, and they told me ahead of time, look, you know, you're an intern, you're gonna have to quit your job, you get a full-time job at the NFL, you get a pension, you got this and that. You're gonna have to quit your job to come do this. And, you know, we're gonna pay you $8 an hour, but we'll show you the ropes and, you know, you'll get a season's worth of experience. But just understand, you're not getting a job out of this. You know, they probably told me 50 times, you're not getting a job out of this.
Okay.
So I quit my job with the NFL and went to the Giants in 05. And I was there for 17 years.
Wow. So, okay, so...
At one point, I was the assistant director of pro scouting for 8 seasons. So, yeah, it was a great, great run. Great organization, great people. You know, I had the time of my life there.
So let's stick a pin in that part right there. So I wouldn't have stopped to think, okay, you said you were working for the NFL, okay? And then you have an opportunity with the Giants. So were you actively applying, or were individual teams looking at NFL Europe and saying, who can we pluck to grow?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I got over there and, you know, I didn't know anything about scouting, obviously. You know, what do I know about scouting? I mean, I knew football, but I didn't know, you know, in the depth that you need to know it to be able to effectively scout, or God forbid, coach. You know what I mean? I tried coaching at one point over there. It didn't go well, but
interesting.
I tried. I was really lucky because NFL Europe was full of great, great teachers. I'm talking, you know, one coach in particular ended up becoming, he was a head coach, he was a defensive line coach, he was head coach of the Berlin team, ended up becoming a head coach in the NFL. There were former NFL coaches that were on staff. Jack Bicknell, you know, obviously from Boston College, was there when I was there. You just had great people to mentor you, and I learned a ton. I worked with two really great people. They taught me the game to a high enough level that I understood it more than kind of the novice person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I really started to get the itch. I said, you know what? Like, I think I could learn this. And
okay.
I went to three different NFL Europe training camps in my time there. I was there for 2 years. One was obviously, you know, kind of an intern. So I was there for three camps. And every team back then would allocate players to NFL Europe. So every NFL club would show up in Florida for training camp. You'd see scouts from every team.
Okay.
And, you know, I had the opportunity to talk with the pro director for the Giants. And, you know, that's how the whole thing started. So, yeah, to answer your question, I was kind of seeking out what opportunities were there. And, you know, you start getting that itch, right? Like, oh, man, I love football.
Mm-hmm.
You're never going to have a chance to win a Super Bowl. You're never going to have a chance to win a ring if you're just working for the league. So you get that itch that you really want to know, all right, what's it like to work for a club? And the best way I can explain it is, if you want to be a coach, there's a lot of ways you can learn how to do that. You can go join a college. You can be a grad assistant. You can learn how to coach that route. And then if you want to try the pros, fine. If not, you can stay in college. If you want to learn to be a scout, you know, you can't go to school and get a master's degree in physical education while you're contributing to the football program. You know, typically, you might be able to do that at some of the bigger schools, but for the most part, you just kind of have to dive in and hope you get lucky and get an NFL front office and do everything you can, work your ass off to, you know, learn it and get ahead and carve out a role. So that was the approach I took.
So let's fast forward just the tiniest bit. So now it's 2005. You have now left.
Yeah.
You have now left the very cushy job of working for the NFL. Actually, before we get to 2005, can you shut your eyes and tell me what you would be doing in 2023 right now had you stayed with the NFL? Had you worked with NFL Europe until it fizzled out, and then they threw you back to the U.S. to go to the NFL office in L.A.?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I don't have a good answer for you because, like I said, I was in the London office, which is kind of their European headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, now there's such great opportunity over there, you know, with the games. Who knows? I mean, there could have been an opportunity on the business side, you know, in a certain role there. There could have been an opportunity with the NFL League office in New York. I don't really know. I wasn't thinking that far ahead, but I love the word cushy, to be honest with you, because my father, I remember having great conversations with him, and, you know, he basically, you know, told me I was nuts a few different times. Like, what are you doing? What the hell are you doing? Like, the NFL is paying you, they're paying for you to travel around Europe, and you have a pension. He's like talking to me about retirement.
Sure.
Do you know what a pension is? Do you know what retirement savings is? You know, so it's like, yeah, your mind. You know, the pound is worth, you know, $1.5. Like, what are you doing?
Damn.
You know, and you're gonna give that all up to be an intern? Like, what are you, crazy? You know, so it was not an easy decision, but at the same time, it's like, this is your hometown team.
Yeah.
This is the opportunity of a lifetime. You know, you get one shot at this stuff.
So
you go for it.
So, ladies and gentlemen, let me just go ahead and do a bit of a reset, but a bit of a filler. So if, for those of you who just got in the car, if your spouse was driving and suddenly just picked you up and you guys are now on a road trip together and you didn't come for the beginning of this, I'm talking with Mr. Matt Schauger, who used to work for the New York Giants and for the NFL Europe and the NFL in Europe. So he is also a fellow graduate of Kittatinny High School, class of 1997. This is how I know that he is a Jersey kid who grew up a Giants fan, because we both did. Now, with that little bit of filler just to throw in, it is now 2005. You have now taken the internship.
Well, hold on a second. Let me just back you up there for
yes.
a second.
Yes, please.
You know, the very first NFL game I ever attended, by the way, was with you and your father. Let's get that on the record.
Oh, my. Oh, go figure.
Absolutely.
I forgot.
At the great Giant Stadium. Greatest stadium ever.
The original Meadowlands. Yes.
Yeah.
That is very funny, that if I'm going to sit here and reminisce for one quick second, just how much my dad did not like football. He wasn't a... my father wasn't a sports guy. He loved... Dad was an old school black man who loved boxing. He liked boxing.
Yes, yes. I remember having great conversations with him about Tyson and...
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes, yeah. When you used to go to the Rockaway Mall, they used to do that random kiosk with the big big prints of movie posters or sports this or whatever. One of the few times I remember my father lighting up was when I showed him a giant print of Muhammad Ali.
And because
basketball didn't do much for him, baseball did nothing for him, and I kid you not, Mom and Dad and I went to a hockey game, a Devils game at the time it wasn't the Burn Arena, it was probably just the Continental Arena. But Dad actually fell asleep. It was a Saturday night. We were in like section 119. We were in the low bowl, and we were probably 17, 18 rows back. Dad fell asleep in the second period. So that is a phenomenal...
That's awesome.
That's phenomenal that you just reminded me of that. Because was it a preseason game? Yes, it was, because it was against the Indianapolis Colts.
I remember the whole thing. And your dad was such a great guy.
Yes.
And he just... God, I remember so many great stories. And, you know, it was funny. I was thinking of him early on when I got hired by the Giants, because... there was an old scout who was a great... He got, unfortunately, he passed shortly after I joined the club, but he told a great story about one of the former offensive linemen around the club was dating a girl. This guy, Rosie, had gone on to become a scout for the Giants, and so he told some great stories over the years, and he somehow started dating Muhammad Ali's girlfriend.
Huh.
Didn't know it. Stayed the same girl Ali has dated. So he shows up at a party in the city and finds out during the party, after he'd already arrived, that he was there with Ali's girl. And now he sees Ali in the corner. He's like, oh my God. Now you're talking about a huge man. You're talking about a guy that's probably 6'7", 6'8", probably 330, somewhere in there. I mean, big man.
Yeah.
And at some point, you know, everything, night's going fine, you know, he's thinking, you know, he's gonna get in some kind of fight or whatever, and nothing happens. Night's winding down, he's getting ready to leave. Ali sees him, he comes over and he puts his arm around him, and whispers in his ear, something along the lines like, you know, you ever go near my girl again, like, you're dead.
Mm-hmm.
And gives him an uppercut to the ribs.
Oh.
That was so fast and so violent, nobody even saw it, and dropped him to his knees. And he might have, I don't know, he broke a rib or what. That was it.
Wow.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh. So, yeah, I always thought of your dad when I heard that story.
Go figure. That is, wow. Go figure. So, I am officially knocked over with a feather because I'm not even going to lie. I absolutely forgot that we went to that game together because it's been so stinking long.
Yeah.
Wow. That, wow. Ladies and gentlemen listening to All New, All Different, All of the Above, you are, I don't know if blushing is the correct answer, but my face is warm with all of these memories. This is phenomenal stuff. So let's go ahead and get back on track for one quick second. As I'm going to take a breath after I ask this question. So here we are at 2005. You've now taken the internship. First and foremost, did you move back in to a parent's house, or were you able to find somewhere dirt cheap in New Jersey, which doesn't really exist?
I shouldn't say that. I moved because I didn't have a place. I moved in with my parents for about. I started with the Giants in June of 2005.
Okay.
And then typically, you know, everybody goes away on vacation middle of June. And then you get about, you know, anywhere from a month to 6 weeks off, and then training camp starts. So, I made the trek from my parents' house for probably a month, something like that, and that got real old. And, when you've been out on your own for a long time, you're dying to move in. So I had a friend who actually wanted to go see the world, believe it or not. He went to China, he went all over. He had a great apartment in Hoboken.
Okay.
And so I subletted an apartment. My first season with the Giants, I subletted a place. So I was living in Hoboken, and eventually I moved a little further out to West New York, which was cheaper, and that was disaster. That was the hellhole that you're describing. Got out of there after about a year and then moved to Rutherford. Giant Stadium was in East Rutherford. Moved to the other side of the tracks, and I was there for a long time. Rutherford's one of the great towns. And moved away from there after my kids were born, or just prior to my kids being born, I should say, my daughter being born.
Okay.
But I was there for like 8 or 9 years.
So now here we are in 2005. You've just gotten started as an intern. So let's see if I can go back in Giants history. I'm not looking at any screens right now. This is me, Johnny Carson style, just holding the card up to my forehead. This is Ernie Accorsi. Is this the GM at the time?
Correct.
Okay. So we are now. Let's see if I tag all this. So now, the New York Giants are led by June of 05, have been led by Eli Manning for just a very short amount of time. What was the temperature like as you were heading into working for the New York Giants with Eli Manning the proposed
Eli
future?
He had taken over late in that 04 season. So 04 was Coach Coughlin's first year.
Okay.
So I came in the spring after his first season with the club. So there was a lot of, from what I was told, it was a lot of turnover in terms of the roster. And listen, whenever you get a coach, you have to find commonalities in terms of their philosophy. You got to understand, especially as a scout, you have to understand what's the scheme, what are you looking for, what are the job descriptions for players, and everybody's got to be rowing in the right direction. Everybody's got to be on board. You know, you got a new sheriff in town, and he's got his rules, he's got his way of doing business, and, you know, you have to learn that way. You know, for me, you know, I'm an outsider coming in. I don't know any different, you know, so whatever. Whatever they teach me the first day I'm on the job is what I know, right?
That's so perfect.
It was very easy for me to, you know, buy in and, you stay in your lane and you do what you're told. And, you know, and I loved it. It was, you knew, you could see everything flip, right? You could start to see they'd gone to the Super Bowl in 2000, obviously lost to that great Raven team. But it was only 4 years prior, right? So you still had, you know, a lot of talent on the roster. Now you have a quarterback, and, you know, he's young, and you have, you know, guys you can build around. They had just finished free agency. In that year, they landed Plaxico Burress, landed Antonio Pierce to play middle linebacker. Kareem McKenzie came over from the Jets to play right tackle. So you had these foundational pieces that were added to the roster, and, you know, all of a sudden now you've got Plax, you've got Jeremy Shockey, remember, who's still on the team.
Yeah.
You have, you know, a great offensive line. You guys like Richie Soybert, they had drafted Chris Snee from Boston College. You had one of the great all-time offensive lines in Giant history that were entering their prime together. Signed Sean O'Hara. You know, so you had a lot of talent. David Deals ended up playing left tackle for us. You just had great O-line. You had a great quarterback. He was young. You knew the sky was the limit. And, you know, we ended up going to the playoffs, and we played the Carolina Panthers that year. We literally lost all three of our starting linebackers. All three were playing a 4-3 back then. All three starting linebackers go down, like, the week before the playoff game. We're literally trying to sign guys off the street to start in the playoff game. And so that was an experience. So we still knew it was a good team. It was a playoff team. There was some roster tweaking that needed to be done, but you knew that in, I think Ernie Corson made the comment at his retirement, then, like, he knew when he stepped away that the team was ready to compete for not one, but multiple championships. And, you know, the 07 draft is one of the greatest drafts that ever took place. It was the draft, you know, we got Bradshaw, Matt Bradshaw.
On the back end.
So now we get, yeah, we get Brandon Jacobs playing running back, Bradshaw. I mean, you had Corey Webster was a second round pick for us at one point. He ends up coming in and, you know, being a starter for us. And it was just a magical time. It really was. I was learning a ton. The NFL, I will tell you, is it is not easy now. It's not. All the stuff that you hear about 85, 90-hour work week, 7 days a week, and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that's real. You know, but when you're young and energetic, and, you know, the biggest thing is you got to have a passion for it, right? There are a lot of people that go into it, and they don't understand that. They get caught up in the whole, oh, wow, you know, this celebrity, this guy, I see this guy. And that wears off after about a day, and then you got to do the work.
So while we're here, so now we kind of sort of careened into the 2007 season. So if you would, if you could just hammer out a story of you in the depths of, so you started in 05, so now here we are in 2007. This is what turns out to be the Giants season, where they win the Super Bowl over the then undefeated New England Patriots. So now, if you just want to...
So 07, for the record, if any of our friends from ESPN are listening in, ESPN, you know, we're up in... So back then, we had training camp in Albany, New York, University of Albany. And that was a great experience in terms of team building, to be able to be away and be with the club and... The bonding piece, I can't say enough about it. Strahan, if you remember, was on the fence about whether or not he wanted to play.
Yes.
So we had lost to the Eagles in Philly in the 06 playoffs. I think they beat us on like a last second field goal. And, you know, so Strahan didn't know if he wanted to play. He had gone away. I think he was on a beach in California collecting his thoughts for the summer, and, you know, we didn't know. You know, we were hopeful, you know, obviously he was going to come back. He comes back, he plays, and it was funny enough, ESPN in training camp, by the way, said we were going to go 5-11. So that lit fire under my ass.
Okay.
We're coming in the office one day, yelling at everybody, telling them, you know, ESPN thinks we're going to go 5-11. So, you know, it was just a fun time, and because we knew the roster could compete with anybody. But that's fun. Like all that shit on paper. And pardon my language there, but you know, all that stuff like doesn't mean anything. When you make acquisitions, you do everything else, you look good on paper, like, you know, everybody's got to buy in, right? You got a great coaching staff, you know, but the players have to believe it, and you have to perform, is what it comes down to. Anytime you win a championship, you know, 90% of the credit goes to the players. So we were okay to start the season. What really flipped it for us, to be very honest, and this was special for me, is we went to London together. And that was a hell of a trip. So we played. So here I am, right? I'm 2 years removed from working, you know, in London for mm-hmm. the NFL.
Yeah.
I'm coming back. Coming back over there. And I'm bringing the Giants with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're going to play in the first ever regular season game in NFL history, outside of the U.S., you know, in Europe.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was a cool experience, I'm not going to lie. And I remember getting into the team hotel, and Shockey was there, and he asked the bellhop where Mr. Bean's house was. And it was a hell of an experience, man. There was one player who went out and ran the tables at the club, you know, the night before the game, and came in with a ton of cash. I got some great stories, but you know, that game, really that whole experience, we practiced out at Chelsea's headquarters, Chelsea Football Club.
Sure.
We were at their practice facility. We had all this international media. Now this is New York, right? So we're playing in New York City. You got, you know, the media's out there every day, right? It's the biggest media market in the world, so you're kind of used to that. But when you get it on an international scale, all of a sudden it's like you're there for Super Bowl week, you know what okay. I mean? And I think for a lot of guys, that's when it really flipped. And the thing that we had done in the off season, we had some really talented young players, but we had a couple guys that didn't know how to win, and that's a real thing in the NFL pro sports. Like, you have to have guys that know how to win and can teach young guys how to win. Learning how to win is a process.
Hmm.
And we didn't quite get there in those 2 years that I was with the club. And then all of a sudden we bring in, you know, we brought in Sam Madison.
Yeah.
Who was with Miami, you know, great player, was on the end of his career, but he came in, he became another starter for us. We signed R.W. McQuarters and free agency, and so now you got a few of these guys that have been around the league, and you got this great mix of young talent, and you've got guys that have played and they know what it's like to win. And when we got to that Miami game in London, that's when the whole thing flipped for us. It's like somebody hit a switch. All of a sudden we started to realize, hey, this is, you know, we got a great team here. And we just started building off of that. And honestly, that was the catalyst for us, was that London game. And then it just went and it went and it went, and then, you know, I was lucky. So the way we would do it back then, the advances we kind of worked on as a four-man staff. You know, we had four people kind of working on the advance together each week. But we would have one scout assigned to a club. So you would have one person going on the road doing the advance work live, and they were ultimately responsible for the bulk of the advance.
Okay.
So I just, by luck, I got the Patriots assigned to me.
Okay.
So I'm the advanced guy for the New England Patriots. Partly because, you know, they're a non-conference team, right? You want your director, you know, looking at the teams in your own division, because those are critical mm-hmm. games that you have to win. You know, so you give the non-opponent teams to, you know, the young scout. So I get the Patriots, and nobody knew, hey, oh, by the way, this team's going to be, you know, undefeated. I was actually at, believe it or not, I was at the game. Back then, we had a great agreement with the Jets where we would could go to any game we wanted. I would literally go to an NFL game every weekend. So I was either on the road playing it, or if team was away, I'd be at a Jet game.
Oh,
I was at the game, the Spygate game. Remember when the whole thing happened with the camera going down and they got caught?
Yeah.
I was at that game. I was up in the press box, watched the whole thing happen live.
Wow.
So fast forward to whatever it is, week...
It was the December. 16,
something like
that.
Yeah,
it was December.
December. Mm-hmm. Yep. I show up in Foxborough. There's a blizzard the night before. Drive to the game in like a foot of snow. And I get to the press box. And they have me in the end zone. Like the third row up. I'm right in the middle of the media with the Boston Globe and all these other people. They got these real cushy office chairs that everybody sits on in the press box. And I look at the chart and I see my seats. I got a metal folding chair. Now, you want to talk about gamesmanship. A freaking metal folding chair. If you sat on this folding chair, you're literally like table height. So you can't see anything. So that was my first exposure to the New England Patriots. I remember having to go back and forth with the PR guy there, put the folding chair, told him where to stick it. So that was my first exposure to the Patriots. So then I come back and, you got to present to coaching staff. What are you going to tell these guys? We're going to play these guys the regular season finale, okay?
Yep.
If we lose this game, they will go undefeated on our field. And oh, by the way, they're the best team in the NFL right now.
Yeah.
Like, what are you going to tell them? You know what I mean? So you're this young guy trying to explain to the coaches, like, how good the Patriots are. You know what I mean? And the way we would do it back then is the person that did the advance would be with the coaches the following week up in the box. So you're trying to help them identify, certain things, personnel, deployment, try to help them, with whatever they need up there on game day. So I was up in the box, watched the Patriots beat us. The great thing about it was, and you've probably seen this in a bunch of different specials, but we'd already qualified for the playoffs. We beat Buffalo the week before, up in a crazy weather game up in Buffalo. And Ahmad Bradshaw was running wild in that game. So we qualified for the playoffs. Even if we win the game against the Patriots, it doesn't affect our playoff seeding whatsoever.
Okay.
So there's essentially no reason to play anybody. You want to treat it like, it's the third the second preseason year, the last preseason game, whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
And Coach Coughlin very quickly decided, no, we're going to play. Now we didn't, full disclosure, we probably didn't prepare for that thing, like we would a regular game. In terms of scheming and, the coaches doing all their homework and all that stuff, I think they probably treated it in terms of their preparation like it was a preseason game and then started to get ready for Tampa Bay, who we were going to play in the playoffs. But we played all of our guys.
Okay.
Coach made the decision. He said, look, number one, we're going to respect the integrity of the game, the history of this league, and we're going to go out there and we're going to perform. We're going to play these guys to the best of our ability. Best thing we could have ever done, because the team knew they were getting to be good. We played that game and we physically manhandled them. If you ever get a chance, watch the ESPN Brady documentary, where he describes all the Super Bowls that they've played in.
Okay.
I don't know if you've seen that yet, but
I haven't.
He does a whole episode just on the Giants, the two Super Bowls.
Okay.
He talks about that, and Strahan's on there. Physically, they couldn't handle us up front. They just couldn't on each side of the ball. Our offensive line took it to their defensive line. Their O-line couldn't block our guys. And, they beat us in the game. Part of it was there was a late deep pass. I think Corey Webster slipped. fell down, and then they threw a touchdown. They ended up winning the game that way. But we knew we could, you know, without really, you know, just showing up and playing football, if we ever got a chance to play these guys again, we were going to kick their ass. That was kind of the mindset. So, you know, it was the best thing that could have happened to us. And then we carried that into the playoffs. And, we got to the Super Bowl, and you know, we had that crazy game in Green Bay, you know, if you remember.
Oh, yes.
However many 30 degrees below zero, wherever the hell it was, and
yep.
Brett Favre. But, we got to the Super Bowl, and we were really confident. And then, you know, one of our star players slips in the shower, hurts himself, blacks out. We didn't even know if he was going to play in the game.
Really?
And, yeah, he got hurt. He didn't practice all week, and it was crazy. We got to the game, and you know how that whole thing turned out. So, you know, it was just an incredible experience.
And if you would, can you please confirm or deny the following statement? I heard from fellow graduates of our high school that you said to your lovely lady, for whom I know, she went to our rival high school, you said to your lovely lady, you're not getting a ring until I get one with the Giants.
Well, I'm going to plead the fifth on that one. I don't think we want to revisit that stuff. But. Hey, look, it all worked out in the end one way or another, right? So,
So just super duper fast, we can talk. The two of us could talk football until our faces fall off. I could listen.
We could talk for hours. We only got up to 2007. We could keep going.
So I do want real quick, you mentioned just a little bit ago that 80 to 90 hours is ridiculously normal for working with an NFL team. So I listened to Tom Coughlin's book, Earn the Right to Win. I have not listened to the second one yet, but he speaks a ton about his now departed wife and how much of a rock she was.
What a special woman. What a special lady she was,
So now, if you would, can you just talk for one quick second about what it was like for your wife? What was it like as you were dedicated to this job, but now you're, what was it like for you who loved football as much as her?
Yeah, so for me, you know, part of the reason why I was able to last as long as I was able to last, because number one, she was incredibly supportive. She, as you know, is brilliant. I'm not exaggerating. My wife is literally brilliant. She's super talented, creatively as gifted as any person I've ever met in my life. And, you know, one of the reasons why it worked was because at the time she was a novelist. She had several books published that hit the Times list, USA Today bestseller list. And when you are at that level of writing, it takes intense focus. You need quiet, you need time to research, you need time to whatever, you know. So, you know, as many hours as I put in football, she put just as many in terms of writing. So I would leave, you know, in the morning, she'd be sitting there hammering away on the keyboard and writing, and you know, typically she was still writing by the time I got home.
Huh.
You know, and then we would kind of live the, it was almost like living a college life for a little while in terms of, you know, I'd come home at, you know, 9, 10 o'clock, whatever it was, and we'd go out to the diner and have dinner at 10, 10:30, you know what I mean? Like, we lived like we were a couple people living in Paris, you know what I mean? It's just, that's how it went for a long time. So, you know, I think she liked, you know, I'm sure she wasn't happy that I wasn't around as much, but in terms of her creative space and ability to work, it just worked for us for a long time. When it gets hard is when, you know, she wasn't doing that, when we had, you know, we had our daughter 2015, and then you know, now we have a son as well. So when you got the young kids and your life changes and you're not around, that's when it gets really hard.
And obviously she has been supportive all throughout, and obviously you two are still together. I know this because, wait, what, was she home with the kids when I saw you back in May?
She was, yeah.
Okay, so everything worked out just fine. Okay.
Yeah.
So...
yeah, and then, you know, we had to live through the pandemic. That was a whole, you know, for everybody, right? Everybody, I'm sure you have 1,000 people on your show, and, you know, they tell you a different story about how the pandemic changed their lives. But, yeah, I mean, it's hard when you have to, when you have something that you're committed to like that, and it's that many hours, and, you know, especially when you have a little ones, man, it gets difficult.
So now I will ask you this as we transition away from home. So if you could, can you think of, during your time as a scout, and wait, did you say the director of pro scouting?
I was the assistant director of pro scouting. Assistant
director. Okay. So in your time as a scout and then as the assistant director, when you like shut your eyes and think about the influences or the people that influenced you, can you just like just snap your finger, think of the first person on the field that gave you some huge impression, and then think of somebody off the field. It doesn't have to be anybody we know, but what did they bring to you?
Well, that's a, you know, so for me, it was, you know, I was really lucky because at one point, For a number of years, my office was literally next to the head coach's office. I mean, separated by a wall. Like, we shared, you know, we shared a wall. And, you know, so I grew up with Coach Coughlin. And sometimes the lessons that you learn aren't just about football. You know, you learn, especially as a young man, you learn life lessons, right? You learn how to be a better person. You learn about commitment. You learn about, you know, how to treat people, how to manage your time, how to, you know, finish things, you know, in terms of time management, how to, you know, that whole thing. Like, you learn life lessons about just how to be a man, how to grow up, how to, you know, handle situations. And you know, so being around him obviously was, you know, very humble. I mean, there's so many great people. You know, the director of the department, still a very close friend, general manager, you know, the pro director ends up, Dave Gelman, he ended up going to Carolina, came back as our general manager. You know, he was very impactful in terms of my development. And you know, there's too many great people, you know, to kind of name one. Mm-hmm. But to be honest with you, when you work those hours, you learn a lot, right? You learn a lot about football, certainly, but you also learn about how to live your life and how to manage time. Sometimes you learn what not to do, right? I mean, unfortunately, I was around a lot of guys, coaches in particular, who had families away from the area, and you know, some of them didn't work out. Some guys got divorced. And, you know, so sometimes you learn what not to do too as well. And you got to remember, you know, for me, I was a young kid going into it. I was only a few years removed from, really think about it, from high school. You know, I went through college and then I got into the NFL right out of college. So, you know, you're growing up in that environment, you know, as the players do.
Yeah.
It's a learning experience for them too.
So, if you're talking about things you learned from the people around you, you said you learned what to do, what not to do, how to better live your life, how to better manage. You never shot yourself in the leg, did you?
No, I didn't do that. Okay. I will say this.
Yes.
You know, in terms of just football, my biggest regret is that 2008 season, and for everybody listening, in my time there, the 2008 team was easily the best team. Easily the best. One of the best teams in modern history of the NFL.
Really?
No joke. I mean, that team, I can't even remember. I think we started off like 10-0 or something prior to that incident. So, you know, we talked about it a little bit about how the team kind of got its identity and learned every week how to get good. You know, we hit the Super Bowl in stride. And after that game, it was like the light had come on. And all these guys knew. You know, I don't think they knew. A lot of the players, I don't think, quite realized how good they were. After we won that Super Bowl in 07, these guys knew how good they were. Mm. And they were legitimate badasses. And they knew they could beat anybody, they could whip anybody in the NFL. We ended up playing the Ravens. So this is just to put in perspective how good that team was. You have four teams that play in the conference championship, right? Two teams in the NFC, two teams in the AFC.
Sure.
We played all four of the teams that made the conference championships, plus, I want to say, Washington, Dallas, maybe Philly, in consecutive weeks. Consecutive weeks.
Mm.
We beat them all.
Oh, boy.
Beat them all. And, you know, we went to Pittsburgh. I don't think Pittsburgh gained a yard in the fourth quarter. I don't think they gained a yard. Beat them on their own field. We played the Ravens. Now, this is the great Raven team with Ray Lewis and Suggs and all those guys.
Mm-hmm.
They hadn't given up a 100-yard rusher in 20 games, or I don't know what the record was, but something like that. I think we ran for like 210 on them in the game.
Mm.
I mean, these guys, they could beat you any way they wanted to beat you. And, you know, unfortunately, that whole thing happened, and, you know, we ended up losing Philly in the first round of the playoffs, but that team could have been one of the all-time great Super Bowl champions.
So, I know my time with you is growing reasonably short, so I'm trying to pull through a spider web here of how to ramp down.
We're going to have to do a part two. We're going to have to continue this whole thing.
Yeah, you are absolutely singing my song right now. I have no problem with that whatsoever. So I will ask you to close us out with, if you can tell any of these stories. You told me a story as we're sitting at a bar in New Jersey, and if this story stays at that bar in New Jersey, fine with me. Can you tell either the story of the draft day trade, I believe that didn't happen, or when one of the coaches who was no longer with the Giants got laughed out of the room?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if I want to touch any of those. I will tell you. How about this one? Right?
Please.
Yeah, there is a very. The only thing I'll say about that one is there is a very special player. I think everybody in the NFL knows. I think if you took a poll of, you know, who the best player in the league is, regardless of position, I think you'd have, you know, one guy in particular who gets a lot of those votes. And you know, if he had gone to a different club via the draft, maybe history is rewritten. But you know, we'll save that story for the bar. But
I understand.
I'll say this, you know, one cool story, I think I might have sent it to you this week. This is one of the great stories that ESPN did a feature on it, if anybody gets a chance to read it. This is an absolute true story. So, since we were talking about the 07 game, we win the Super Bowl. Everybody's excited. One of the all-time great people we had on the business side of our building came up with the idea. He said, hey, look, you know, we're in New York City. We're in the biggest market in the country. Why don't we get these rings made by Tiffany? You know, so our Super Bowl rings were actually made by Tiffany. Back then it was, you know, Balfour and some of these other companies. So I believe we were one of the first clubs to get a Tiffany ring, which was super special because obviously they make the trophy.
Okay.
The Lombardi trophy that you get is made by Tiffany, which is obviously an iconic New York City jeweler. So we all get invited to go to this big ring ceremony at Tiffany. It's kind of like in the movie, right? So we all get off the bus, we walk into Tiffany and Company, Fifth Avenue. We walk in, they got the lights off, turn the lights on for everybody, and they got the Super Bowl rings laid out on the counter for all the players and the coaches. And it's just great ceremony. So, you know, everybody, I'm super excited because I'm like, you know, it's the spring, I'm fired up, I'm going to get the Super Bowl ring, and, you know, they give out the rings, and there's a bunch of us. We're all like, what the hell's going on? I didn't get my ring yet. Where's my ring? You know, you're thinking they're going to, like, hand it to you in a box on the bus or something, you know? And a lot of us didn't get rings, and we couldn't figure it out. And then we, I believe we had a meeting or something. They said, well, there was a production issue, and you know, they're working it out. You're going to get your ring. Don't worry about it. You know, it's just going to take a little more time. So we ended up getting June or whatever. I come home one day, and my wife says, hey, you better turn on the news. It's a story about your ring. What? Turned on. So Tiffany had the production facility for these rings was in Massachusetts.
Okay.
Right down the road from where the Patriots play.
Oh, no.
There was a crazy master thief who had figured out, crazy Patriot fan, diehard Patriot fan, he had figured out that they were making the Giant Championship rings in Massachusetts at this facility. And he and his crew somehow figured out how to bust into this place, got a crane, came in, took a bunch of rings, and for years, you know, these rings had gone missing. They were stolen. Now, I don't know if my ring was stolen or if they just took my ring and kind of repurposed it and gave it to one of the players, and because obviously you had to get the players their rings first. But,
sure.
It's a true story. If anybody ever gets a chance to read it, ESPN did a feature on it. Eventually the guy got caught, thankfully. But it is a wild story. So, yeah, we beat the undefeated Patriots. They stole our rings. One of the guys stole our rings.
And somewhere in New York, in New Jersey, is just under their breath.
Yeah, right?
Is just under their breath yelling, these effing massholes. I can't stand these people. And now you just gave me another reason. So, Matt, I know you got to go. I know you got dad duties to take care of.
Hey, it's been a pleasure, man. I look forward to part two.
Dude, I cannot wait. We will put that on the books as soon as possible. You have a good night.
You as well.
Thank you, sir. All right. So let me just go ahead and kind of call myself out a little bit. As much as I tell you that I am a devout New York Giants fan, there's two things that I will admit to real quick. I've never been a season ticket holder, and I have never been able to, thanks to my job, I've never been able to watch every single game. There's a lot of people in this world that are fans of any football team, mind you, that will work their work schedule around football. And unfortunately, in my opinion, life doesn't work that way. I have been in the restaurant industry for a very long time. And there has been many a Sunday in my younger days where I had NFL Sunday ticket, and that was the centerpiece of the day. But the older I got, or the different job I went to, or anything, I just became the guy who worked on Sunday. Now, the fact that the New York Giants are part of the New York television media market, it puts them on TV a pretty respectable amount, and it helps when they're good. So I'm able to see them somewhat frequently, and I gotta say a big fat thank you to YouTube and the NFL and whatever partnership they have, because every Sunday night after work, after I take off my shoes, I take off my work clothes, I clean up a little bit, I sit down on the bed in the guest room in our lovely condo, and I put on the YouTube highlights, good, bad, middle of the road, and watch how they did. And so if you, so I can tell you, because I didn't work for the New York Giants, I can quickly tell you that my memory of those seasons is really strong, but it's definitely not as strong as Matt's. And how could it be? You're putting in 80 to 90 hours, and that is your life? Of course, every second of it is going to be in your memory. It's going to be in your skin. It's going to be in you. Because Lord knows, I have been in the service industry for a real long time, and I can tell you so easily, quickly, and wholeheartedly, certain days, certain shifts, certain coworkers, certain guests, they affected me that much in whatever way, shape, or form. So, I don't mince words when I tell you that New York Giants football has been one of the constants in my life. But I have never been in a position where I could eat, live, and breathe it the way that Matt did. It's incredible. It was so fun to listen to as a Giants fan and just as a person who loves passionate conversation with passionate individuals. That was a ton of fun. And by the way, the incident that we talked about, if you didn't remember or if you're not a historically long fan of NFL football or the Giants, Plaxico Burress, wide receiver for the New York Giants, who caught the touchdown to make it 16-14. Michigan State, by the way. He was at a club. I want to say he was wearing maybe sweatpants at the table where they were doing bottle service, and he brought his gun in illegally, and it went off, and he shot himself in the leg. To which, if you heard Matt talk, which I'm pretty sure you did if you've already been listening this far, it pretty much derailed the season. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. There was one other point I wanted to bring up, and I'm not remembering it. And if indeed we do get to talk a second time, which I would absolutely love to do, I'll bring it to you then, because I'm sure it'll come up between here and there. Because all we talked about today was college, London, and really the 2007 season, the first New York Giants Super Bowl ring of this century? Generation? Whatever you want to call it. I've been alive for all of them. There's certain fandom that can't say that for their team of choice. Take that comment however you will. But I remember somewhat vividly watching Phil Simms take apart the Denver Broncos. I very, very, very vividly remember watching Scott Norwood miss the kick that let the Giants win 20-19. I very brutally, very vividly remember the only points that the New York Giants scored in Super Bowl 35. It was Ron Dixon returning a kickoff. The offense looked inept because the Baltimore Ravens defense was just that good. I can tell you exactly where I was when the Giants beat the Patriots the first time. And I can tell you where I was when the Giants beat the Patriots the second time. I was with the same person, by the way. My good buddy. The first Giants-Patriots Super Bowl, we were at his then apartment over near Mockingbird Station, just me and him. And I was texting back and forth with a girl I was into who was a Patriots fan. And I won't lie, the first half of the game, I spent more time being interested in her than I was in the game. But after it came back from the second half, boy, it was just too intense to send that many text messages to that to to that specific girl that wasn't that interested in me to begin with. And by the way, it was 2010, so I was still paying per text message. Remember that? So the 2011 Super Bowl, when the Giants beat the Patriots the second time, I was at the same guy, I was at his then house. He was renting a house in Saxe, which is just on the other, which is on the other side of 75, down George Bush, heading towards, heading past Garland towards Rockwall. For those of you in local DFW, you know where I'm talking about. Otherwise, just picture anywhere USA with a reasonably okay looking house. And this is 2012, this is Feb of 2012, so we're watching the game on delay. We recorded the game and paused it because I had to work that morning. And so we wanted to watch the game from start, no interruptions. So as soon as we sat down, we got our food, we sat down, and we turned our phones off. Because we were easily 2.5 hours behind everybody who had already seen the start of the Super Bowl. The game usually starts at 5:30. It wasn't until almost 8 that we started watching the game. So we were real far behind as Mario Manningham is making the catch of his life, or Ahmad Bradshaw is losing his balance as he's trying to fall in front of the end zone. I can tell you where I was when Kent Graham upset the Denver Broncos. I can tell you where I was when Emmitt Smith played the game of his life, fresh out of a contract holdout. I can tell you where I was getting in a fight with my then-girlfriend about wanting to watch football by myself and grill burgers against the Denver Broncos. When I tell you that I am a devout fan of the New York Giants, I don't mince words. I don't lie to you. And it's funny. I've watched YouTube clips of people who, if you ever watch these YouTube montages, there will be people inevitably that throw a shoe through their television, that punch their TV, that yell at their kids, or just they do some myriad of things because the team of their life just lost. Whether it's a Week 7 game or it's a Week 17 game or it's the Super Bowl. People go intensely crazy over their team winning and losing. So let me just tell you a little something. Whenever I watch videos like that, I don't think about people's fandom, because you know what? I'm somewhat meta in this way. I'm somewhat self-aware in this way. One thing that I really hate, and feel free to try to pump the brakes on me. You can't, because I'm talking into a microphone, and you can only text me or email me to respond, alloftheaboveradio@gmail.com. If there's one thing that makes me a little annoyed, is when somebody says it's just a game. So, I understand that. And I think every fan understands that. So, if you wanna call people out, and I understand we're getting into a little bit of semantics right now. We're kind of pulling at the short hairs as we walk through this conversation. When somebody is kind of losing their mind over the loss of a game, if they've suddenly just destroyed a television, it's not their fandom that you need to be concerned about. It's their actual... You need to be more concerned about how they control their emotions, their temper, their chi, whatever it is you believe in. That football game, that missed field goal, that bad flag that the ref just threw, that is all that has so very little to do with what actually is going on with that person, what they are going through or who they are or how they react to things. Because listen, the same person that throws their shoe through a flat screen TV is probably the same person that has pulled a gun on somebody during a road rage incident. Don't pull the "it's just a game" comment on somebody when they freak out. You gotta instead be like, "Hey, motherfucker, you need some help? You want a hug?" Like, just skip ahead. Don't talk about football in a way that demeans it. Don't talk about the game that these people love in a way that demeans it. Check in on their actual behavior. Check in on who they are. Now, this one's funny though. I did see a YouTube video. So I think it was during the 2022 season that did crack me up, because I've thought about this before. I've said it before to my very, 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 very close friends, never to somebody to their face. There was a YouTube clip. Who knows if it was real, but there was a YouTube clip. A Chicago Bears fan. Bears have just lost, and he's pacing in front of the television, really annoyed, and this woman that apparently he's only been dating for a couple of months pulls the "it's just a game" speech and says, "Why are you so mad? Why are you freaking out? It's just a game." And he says, "I've been a fan of this team for 22 years. I've known you for 2 months. Get out." This is me paraphrasing right now. There was a little more back and forth before he told her to leave, but he said, "I've been a fan of this team for 20 years. I've known you for 2 months." And it's really funny. When I watched that video, there was no part of me that thought, well, he was wrong. Now, let me just recoil and say, we need to check in on his behavior. We need to check in on what's going on with him. And let's just be honest, we need to check in on that relationship. Let's check in on her. Let's not pretend like she's an angel who is just like, "Oh, babe, I'm so sorry. The bear got poked a little bit." She poked the bear a little bit. If you see somebody pacing while wearing a football jersey for a team that, by the way, is not very good, but I'm not even gonna lie, I've said it before. I've said to my very closest friends, whenever I was in the midst of a bad dust up with a relationship, I said, "Yeah, we got into it because I didn't like how she talked while I was watching the game. I've known the Giants a lot longer than her, and the Giants are still gonna be around when she's gone." I've said it. I have absolutely said it. And by the way, it's amazing when you find somebody that is, as the phrase goes, your person. When my wife was doing her job hunt in the summer of 22, she was weighing the options between three different places. And one of them was in the lead for a little while because they're closed on Sunday. She said, "Well, if I work here, the biggest perk is that I get to see the Chiefs play because we're closed anyway." Now, she ended up getting a different job that she loves and pays her extremely well. And so, much like me, she watches the highlights on YouTube the next day. But it's pretty cool when you've got somebody that wants to try to work their schedule around their love of football. That's pretty cool. I mean, if life allows you to do that, I ain't mad at you. I'm not that lucky, gifted, hashtag blessed. But you know what? If you are, cool. More power to you. So, I will close this out on a personal note. And I know this is a very long episode, so those of you who are making a slightly longer drive, I'm happy to be with you, and I hope you're happy to be with me. I gotta tell you, I had absolutely forgotten that Matt and I went to that preseason game. That knocked me over with a feather and damn near brought me to tears to hear somebody that I haven't... to hear somebody talk about my dad in such an uplifting and fun way. I do very vaguely remember Matt and my dad having random conversations as we were heading on into our adult life. And it is nothing short of incredible to hear somebody that I graduated high school with that I haven't talked to intensely in years tell me he thought about my dad years after he had died and years after we had a deep conversation of some sort. At some point or another, I will go back and listen to just that part of the conversation. And I was on a time limit because he's a man with two kids, and it was his job to... he's on kid duty at time of talking to you. He was about to be on kid duty. I had to keep the conversation exactly where it needed to go. But man, That was so fun to be reminded of the fact that we went to a preseason game together as Giants fans, as probably 15 or 16-year-old Giants. We couldn't drive yet. Because if we could drive, we probably would have just done that ourselves. And it's funny, now that I think about it, I'm pretty sure I remember I was sitting on the right... We were probably driving the 94 Dodge Caravan. I was sitting in the passenger passenger captain's chair, and Matt was sitting in the driver's side captain's chair. This is the second row of chairs. Three rows of chairs on this caravan. And I remember driving to Giants Stadium was a mess. It was a god-awful mess, especially when you're living in the country. And Dad was a city driver. He was aggressive, he was a little nutty, and he always made it work. And I remember at one point, he took this weird curb where you just heard the bottom of the van just completely scrape, and it caused Mom to gasp. And in that moment, I just remember wanting to be in the stadium, being at the game, so I thought nothing of the scraping of the bottom of the car. But I remember that. Now that he says it, absolutely, 100%, it was against the Indianapolis Colts. I remember that game. And by the way, not only does Matt have this cool memory of my dad, but he's got a cool memory of me. That was a great phone call, personally and for the sake of this show. And I very much am looking forward to catching up to him again. And man, if I'm ever given permission to tell you the stories that he told just sitting at the bar back in May, oh my God, so awesome. So awesome. Whew. Well, ladies and gentlemen, it's about time to close this one out, because I'm looking at how long I've been recording. I'm looking at this timer. This is a very long episode. This is reminiscent of the old days where I had 2 hours to fill and enjoyed doing it. If you want to ask me, did I enjoy doing this today with as much time as it's taken me? Damn right I did. By the way, you guys know the drill. If you want to chat with me, if you want to start a dialogue, alloftheaboveradio@gmail.com. Go to my regular Instagram page, at Hank. Hey, how you doing? You can find me on at Hank Told You So, but I haven't been on in a long, long, long time. As spotty as I am with content for this show, I'm even more spotty with content on the Instagram page. Still a fun look, though. So we will do this again soon. And soon after that, and soon after that, and soon after that. It's been a good one, and I'm glad I was able to bring it to you. My name is Hank. This has been all new, all different, all of the above. May there be a next time. I say till next time.